Dialogue series Dancing in the Liminal, a global border crossing inquiry into art, activism, spirituality, and leadership for the 21st century. I'm your dialogue hostess, Vanessa Fisher, and I'm here with my honored guest, Marianne Williamson. Marianne is an internationally acclaimed spiritual author and lecturer. She's the author of numerous books, including A Return to Love, Everyday Grace, A Woman's Worth, and Healing the Soul of America. Marianne also founded the Department of Peace Campaign, a grassroots campaign to establish a United States Department of Peace. I contacted Marianne recently after hearing about an upcoming event that she was putting on this coming November called Sister Giant, which is aimed to get more women engaged in the political process and to bring a new conversation to spiritual political leadership and the forefront of American politics. After contacting Marianne, I also picked up her book, A Return to Love, which I was quite impacted by on many levels, and so I'm really inspired to have Marianne here and really appreciate her initiative and willingness to take up leadership roles in both the spiritual and political worlds. So, Marianne, it's a real pleasure to have you here, and welcome.
Well, thank you, Vanessa. It's an honor to be here, and I really admire the kind of programming that you're doing, too.
Thank you. I wanted to start with your background. I was just reading A Return to Love and really had a lot of resonance with your personal journey, and I thought maybe if you wanted to just talk a little bit about how you came to the Course of Miracles and then how that led into your spiritual path and eventually into sort of the interest in politics and how those came together for you, if you wanted to share a bit.
Well, you know, when I was growing up, you read the I Ching and Alan Watts and Ram Dass and things like that. Those kinds of writings were in the air. And at the same time, I studied comparative religion and philosophy. So I was always interested in anything that had to do with, you know, whether it was Kierkegaard or astrology. I've always been fascinated by the mystical realms, the philosophical realms. But when I found the Course in Miracles when I was in my 20s, that's when all of these universal spiritual themes were presented in a way where I could see how to apply them in a practical way to my own life. Mm-hmm. You know, the Course in Miracles isn't for everyone. It doesn't claim to be. But if it's for you, you know it. It's just kind of a jolt. It's not a religion, but it deals with universal spiritual themes. And I think that that's part of the irony of the times in which we live. On the one hand, you have these absolutely horrifying ways in which the separation among religions, the doctrinal and dogmatic religions, are causing, as they have caused so often in history, the most evil consequences, war, atrocities, and so forth. But at the same time, there is this awakening among millions of people in the world of spiritual truths that actually lie at the heart of all the great religious systems and that have to do with something more fundamental than just a belief system, more fundamental than doctrine. They have to do with human experience and how we live our lives and the ground of being on which we stand. And that, of course, is transforming everything. It's transforming business. It's transforming agriculture. It's transforming medicine. It's transforming education. It's transforming so many areas. The one area that is lagging behind, mainly because of the entrenched economic forces that run it, of course, is politics. Mm-hmm. So for me, my spiritual journey, which has to do with my own personal transformation, just like it does for anyone who's exposed, whether it's through a specific exoteric religion or esoteric religion or yoga or recovery program, or even something like, let's say, psychotherapy, where someone is taking an internal journey but keeping it for themselves within a secular context. It doesn't matter. The point is that so many people realize that there's something on the inside, the way we think, the consciousness that is the lens through which we view the world and on which we act, is the most important thing. However, we're also living at a time when more and more people are realizing that it can't be just about you.
Yeah.
That if you're in a journey of the heart, if you're in a journey of love, and no version of enlightenment or spirituality is anything but a journey of love, then how can you ignore a starving child? How can you ignore that 17,000 children are starving every day, or 1 billion people live on $1.25 less a day, another billion on $2 less a day? If if you're an American, how do you ignore that 23.1% of our children live in poverty, which among 35 developed nations in the world puts us second only to Romania? How can we ignore the fact that the United States has the highest incarceration rate? So to me, the spiritual journey doesn't take you away from the deeper, more mature consideration of the great social and political issues of our day, which speak to nothing less than whether or not the human race is even a sustainable option over the next 100 years. So to me, it's just one more way in which, like it is for everyone, walls are falling down that used to seem to separate categories of our experience, and we're really seeing at really deep levels how everything is connected to everything.
Yeah. And this is really interesting, too, because I actually had a friend on Facebook recently writing about how she notices when people, like, she's in these spiritual communities, and when people are talking about spiritual principles, we all seem to be able to agree on oneness and all these things. But then when the issue of politics comes up, it kind of devolves into this intense fighting, even with people who are quite evolved and, you know, can talk really high principles. And so there seems to be sort of this schism that's still there with the political realm and how that integrates with these inner journeys that we've been on.
Well, I think the operative phrase that you just said was, can talk high principles.
Right.
In fact, you can talk high principles. Yeah. Trust me, I would know. It's the least of it. The idea that you can believe even high principles is the least of it. But if you're not standing on high principles, if they are not only high but deep within you, then, you know, it leads to this kind of ersatz spirituality that we see far too much of these days, which actually purports that somehow a spiritual journey gives you a pass on addressing suffering of other living beings, which is, as I said before, it's the most counterfeit notion of enlightenment. The idea of suffering and the transcendence of suffering is at the heart of all the great religious systems. So this idea that you can be all spiritual and keep it all about you, that's not spirituality. That's just kind of dressed up narcissism and an excuse for not helping. It's just an immature developmental stage. But I think it is important to point out that it's not the mature, more evolved spiritual path. You know, Jesus did not concern himself with suffering. Buddha did not concern himself with suffering. Moses did not concern himself with suffering. And you can go down the line of all the great religious and spiritual and philosophical systems. This idea that somehow you can have a serious spiritual or religious conversation and just never go there is, you know, like I said, is it a problem?
Yeah, well, with the time that we're in now, it's become...
Yes, exactly. And I think because, Vanessa, as I said before, I think that those of us who are interested in a spiritual journey should be the last people sitting out these issues.
Yeah. I'm curious, too. I have a question just for you around particularly dealing with conflict, because obviously the political world is, you know, steeped in really toxic conflict. And I think I've spent a lot of time in spiritual communities around spiritual practitioners, and I think there can be an avoidance of conflict, or, you know, that happens if there's an attempt to keep harmony, or just, I don't think we've always been taught the skills how to deal with conflict really well, just as a culture in general. And I think particularly for women, there's an interesting conditioning we sometimes have around wanting to be pleasing and not rock the boat, and that might also lead to not wanting to engage with politics. Are there any of these pieces that fit for you about why maybe spiritual practitioners or women don't engage the political arena, or do you think there's other reasons? What's your kind of sense of it?
Well, absolutely. I think what you're saying is extremely important. This is where things like nonviolent communication skills comes in. You know, you hear people say, even during this political season, oh, I don't want to talk about it because we'll fight. Well, if you look at an intimate relationship, you have to be able to get it out sometimes.
Yeah.
But there are rules. It's called nothing. You can't go below the belt.
Right.
And that's how politics should be. That's how society should be. Only in a totalitarian state can we not have differing opinions.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that we see things differently, the fact that we realize that nobody has a monopoly on the truth, the fact that everybody is coming through the lens of their own experience, that diversity of thought and opinion is rich.
Yeah.
It is not weakness. It is strength that everybody has the emotional safety, that it is an emotionally safe experience for everybody to put their opinion on the table and to be heard without judgment. That doesn't mean without debate. But the idea that we have lost the art and the skill of honorable debate And as I said before, this whole nonviolent communication thing, you know, this is not spiritual when everybody's seething inside, but only talking like this because we don't want to have an argument. That's darkness. That's not, there's nothing really spiritual about that. So part of our spiritual as well as our social skill has to do with learning the way to so take responsibility for the heart space between you and another person that it does feel safe to everybody involved to speak their truth. You know, the word communication has the word commune inside it. So if I don't take responsibility for the heart space between us, then it can be an act of aggression and a transgression for me to state my truth. This is where you have the line in the Course in Miracles where it says, it is your job to tell your brother he is right, even when he is wrong, which doesn't mean tell somebody that you agree with a stupid action that they're taking. What it means is that there is a way for us to learn, and once again, it is a spiritual tool, to affirm the basic goodness and humanity of the person we're encountering. Within that space, people can hear anything, because within that space, people feel safe to have a conversation. And this is, once again, a place where those of us with these spiritual orientations have so much to offer. Now, on a political level, the problem is, among other things, that we have lost this sense of, quote-unquote, the loyal opposition. You know, during one of the debates between President Obama and Mr. Romney, Romney kept saying, well, during Ronald Reagan's time, he would reach out to the other party. Well, yeah, and during Ronald Reagan's time, the other party would reach back. It was called loyal opposition. Today you have a case where even if the president reached, you know, the Republican leadership had already announced that their only goal was to make him a one-term president, to work with him on nothing. So that's just one example in our society where we have allowed enmity and an adversarial perspective to cast aside all notion of the necessity that we argue with honor, but that ultimately synergistically so that the higher truth that, as I said, monopolized by no particular voice is able to emerge. It's a total breakdown in relationships, whether it's intimate relationships, family relationships, or political and social relationships, when we forget this.
Do you think this is partly, like, I mean, this increasing polarization in the States and, you know, in conflicts that are going on, do you think there's some sense that because circumstances are getting more difficult, like materially and all these things, that we tend to devolve in those situations rather than, you know, evolve to higher ways of, you know, operating with each other? Or what's your sense of that?
My sense is that the two are intimately connected. My sense is that in many ways we are devolving as a society and as a civilization, but I also think that the very fact that we are is motivating millions and millions of people to wake up and say, what? Wait, whoa, what is going on here? This is no joke. We've got to wake up. So I see both happening. I mean, even look at the conversation that you and I are having right now. It's a pretty important conversation. And it's really getting at the heart of things. That's what you're dedicating your program to. It's what I'm dedicating my work to. It's what many of us are doing. Well, you know what? Would we be seeking to get this real if there wasn't the peril in the air that there is?
Right.
Right? I mean, do you agree with that?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Crisis tends to come before transformation.
Exactly. So yeah. I think on a certain level, it's simply a race for time. The forces of fear are intensifying. And the forces of love are intensifying. And that's why, you know, even with a program like this, I think social media, the internet,
yeah,
media in general, this is the key to everything. Because more and more voices out there saying the things that we all believe are the most important really eschewing this preoccupation with ultimate meaninglessness that it seems to have sort of taken over American pop culture.
Mm-hmm.
As we create this new field of possibility, this new resonance, this new morphic field, this is one of the greatest, if not the greatest, opportunities we have to really interrupt the patterns of devolution.
And do you want to talk a little bit about the kind of specific thing you're trying to do with Sister Giant and what's your main goal with it and what's part of the program, just what you're doing in the program?
Well, you know, you and I have already spoken, at least indirectly, about a new kind of energy. I mean, it's kind of even in the name of your program. We must turn away from the downward spiral of ultimate unsustainability that we are moving in so many ways in our country and in our world. In the United States, the 23.1% child poverty rate, the high incarceration rate, the environmental breakdowns, there are so many things, including indirect, if not direct, assault on democracy itself in the form of such things as the Citizens United decision. Now, at the same time, look at the U.S. Congress, the makeup of the U.S. Congress, and the makeup of our state legislatures. In the U.S. Congress, we have fewer than 17% of them are women. And on the state legislative level, fewer than 24% are women. I was reading this interesting story the other day, this study that was saying that on a corporate level, in order for a system to really change, you need 30% women. Why do you need 30% women? Because if a man feels 20% confident of his beliefs, he'll speak his mind. A woman will need 80% to have the confidence to speak hers. So there is a voice in society. It's called half the human race. Women are 51% of the population of the United States. We're not a special interest group. And yet our voice, the voice of the feminine, which is, of course, in men and women, but women archetypally hold the space, i.e., what about the children? You know, women are the – it is a woman's job to take care of the children and to take care of her home. But we are evolving to the point of realizing that what that means today is that every child on this planet is one of our children, and the planet itself is our home. So we desperately need this rising voice of saying, what about the children and what about our home? We've got 17,000 children a day who are starving on this planet. You know, I'll tell you something, yeah. Vanessa, just last night I had a really interesting experience. I was speaking to a group of women who definitely represent the 1%. Right? Mm-hmm. And I was talking about these things. And I don't think it's that they don't care. They care as much as anyone that I know cares. But too many people, particularly women, are disengaged from the most powerful tool that we have on a geopolitical level for turning things around. Even I notice it's interesting, Vanessa, the title of your program. You say leadership, but you don't say politics. And we don't say politics because it's so toxic and it's so mean-spirited, nobody even wants to go there. It's in a real conundrum.
Yeah.
Because you can't transform what you don't engage. So I think women particularly, but all of us really, need a new conversation. After, you know, no matter who wins this presidential election, we really need to talk. Not in these presidential debates, they never brought up child poverty. They never brought up poverty. They never brought up global hunger. They never brought up the high incarceration rate. And so there's a bubbling conversation that I think that's why Sister Giant is right after the election, which will include not only a deeper consideration of some of these issues, the whole idea of how can we change the ordering principle of human civilization from economic values to humanitarian values? Because that's the conversation we need to have now about how to return our hearts and our economy and our way of growing food and our way of doing business and everything else, how do we return it to the natural rhythms of the heart, which really are inherent in nature. So this is the conversation that I think Sister Giant can really contribute to, help foster, help incubate. But in addition, because I'm doing it in partnership with the Women's Campaign School of Yale University, there will actually be included a training for women who would consider the possibility, well, maybe I'll run for office one day. We've got to stop keeping politics at arm's length with this holier-than-thou attitude. It's too important. You know, they say in France, if you don't do politics, politics will do you. And for women, I heard it said recently, if women aren't at the table, we're usually on the menu. And you can see that today.
Right. Now, I've interviewed quite a few activists on my series and women who are kind of doing work on the ground in different places. And one of the comments I get from women is that they feel that there's not so much leverage in the actual political process, that there's more leverage.
Well, of course there's not. There's not because we have a political system in the absence of public financing for campaigns, in the absence of a constitutional amendment that will override the nefarious effects of Citizens United by establishing that there will not be undue financial interest in our political functioning. In the absence of that, the people that you're speaking of, the activists, mm-hmm. are basically saying, and they're correct, if you have a plutocracy, a corporatocracy that basically takes for itself all the material resources that they want and then just leave whatever crumbs are left for everybody else, then the activist is left in a situation of saying, how do we divvy up the crumbs? And that's why we need to take this next step into actual political involvement. What your activists are doing are trying to lobby congresspeople and lobby senators and lobby presidents. We need to become the congresspeople and the presidents and the senators now, because otherwise politicians, in order to stay in office, in order to get elected, will always be having to be on some level or another, some better, some worse, handmaidens to a corporate order. And we've got to stop avoiding that. That's the one place where we stop. We stop short of running for office. We stop short of being political voice. And I think it's interesting that you say that the activists are saying that. Absolutely, because that's what people are realizing now. I heard this guy in Wisconsin, and he's a man who ran for lieutenant governor there during the Scott Walker recall. And he was head of the firemen's union. And the interviewer said to him, you're a fireman, you're a firefighter, why are you running for a lieutenant governor? And he said, you know, I've been a firefighter all my life, and all my adult life, and I thought I would retire as a firefighter. He said, but we are first responders. When we hear there's a fire, we go and we survey the scene. And if the fire is bad enough, we can't just protest the fire. We can't just write petitions against the fire. We can't just lobby against the fire. If it's bad enough, we've got to get in there. Right. And I think that's the next conversation for a lot of us on some level, whatever is appropriate for each of us individually. We've got to get in there. We've got to actually create a politics of conscience. We can't just keep avoiding politics and think that we are going to transform the world. Not in time.
And I think that the ideal, like the, at least as I see it, is if there were people in those high positions of power and then the people doing the work on the ground, and there was a strong coordination between the two, it would be really
powerful.
Well,
that's the world as it should be.
Yeah.
we're not trying to get rid of, you know, the non-governmental. You know, we don't want government to do everything, obviously. But that partnership, how can you have a real partnership if it only exists on one side?
Totally, totally. And there is a lot of disconnect right now that I think ends up wasting a lot of resources, a lot of money. And
right, exactly. But you say those people. Who will those people be? You say those people in high places in government. Who are those people going to be if not on a certain level of us? And I think for us as women particularly, you know, I hope this Sister Giant will really, and I want to, in talking about it, I want to point out that even though the event is in Los Angeles, people can participate via live stream.
Okay.
And I hope, in fact, I know that it will inspire people to think more broadly in terms of how all of these ideas can now take a new political dimension if enough people bring their conscious awareness. We don't want to go into that old conversation, but we can recreate the conversation. We can create a new conversation in which our politics and our higher philosophical and spiritual yearnings intersect and align and create something really beautiful and powerful and kick-ass fabulous and all of that.
Kick-ass fabulous.
which is our function after all.
So I'm just curious because I heard you speaking in another interview just about some of the ways we can bring a more spiritual approach to complement or even transform this political process in really practical ways. And one of the principles I heard you speak about that I was quite interested in was atonement, and this principle of atonement of, you know, how it works for both individual and the larger collective. So for the example you gave, I think, in the interview was the United States atoning for its involvement in slavery so as to transform the subtle dynamics of racism that still exist within the culture. So I just thought that was an interesting piece, and I was wondering if you wanted to just share anything about some of these principles that you see could really transform the political systems in some sustainable ways.
Well, what you just said is absolutely true. You know, even Abraham Lincoln, in declaring a day of prayer, said that a country has to confess its sins as well. Atoning for slavery is certainly an example. Atoning for the genocide of the Native American peoples is another example. Atoning for the Vietnam War is an example. I think, actually, at this point, atoning for the Iraq War is an example. There are places where the United States, like any individual, because all that a group is a collection of individuals, nobody's life goes forward until first we take a good look at our own character defects.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it's the you know, fearless moral inventory and looking at your character defects in AA or confession in Catholicism or the Day of Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement in Judaism, there is no serious philosophical or spiritual path that does not include the inner work that is involved in resetting the trajectories of your own future,
yeah.
which comes about from saying, I get where I got it wrong, and I admit where I got it wrong, and I will do what it takes to make it right where formerly I got it wrong. And absolutely a country needs to do this, just like an individual has to do this. You know, Germany, after World War II, I mean, there's been some amazing atonement as well as amends on the part of Germany since World War II. The generations following World War II didn't try to, you know, get out of admitting the complete, utter, evil, full-tilt, catastrophic influence of Adolf Hitler on the planet. And I don't think that Germany would be where it is today in terms of its vital economy, its own abundance, its own progressivism. I don't think it wouldn't be as blessed by the universe as it were today had it not done that inner work as well as the outer work of making things right.
I think this is a really important piece. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a really important piece. And so for a real intersection and alignment of spirituality and politics, we have to address these internal issues as well as the external issues. The United States, as a collective, we need to ask ourselves, are we standing on the principles on which we purport to stand?
Yeah.
And the current political dynamic is all about tinkering with the externals.
Yeah.
And it's not about just tinkering with the externals. It's also about looking deep at the internals, which is why those of us with that orientation, I think, have a lot to contribute to the conversation.
Yeah, and I had a past guest who I talked to a lot about racism. She's an African-American woman and said that, you know, just changing policy, like when they legislated abolition of slavery, it did not eradicate racism in the culture. And so it takes more than policy, and it's that combination.
Absolutely, and that's what I've been writing about for years, the stroke of a presidential pen by eradicating the institution of slavery, and certainly was a very important thing.
Very.
But as you just said, the stroke of a presidential pen can eradicate an external reality, but it takes other generations to really eradicate racism. You see the same thing with women. We don't burn women at the stake anymore, at least in the Western world, but we have not yet eradicated from the psyche of the Western mind this projection of suspicion towards any woman a powerful woman who really speaks her mind.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the tragedy when it comes to the racism and the slavery thing was, and this had largely to do with the fact that Lincoln was killed, like literally days after the surrender at Appomattox. He really stood for, you know, that magnificent line in the second inaugural, with charity towards all and malice towards none. He was talking about the attitude the North would take to the South. They would not treat a vanquished enemy with, you know, viciousness. And when he died, and the pent-up anger after 4 years of war on the part of the North, the attitude towards the South, the punishing attitude towards the South, actually made racism burrow deeper underground. That's when you get the John Birch Society and Ku Klux Klan and all of those. So these issues,
these deeper, subtle
issues,
dynamics. Yeah,
and not so subtle on an internal
plane.
And they have very not subtle political consequences that they're not addressed.
Yeah. Beautiful. Well, I know you're out of time, and it's been a real pleasure, and I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me.
Well, I'm sorry that I don't have more time right now, but I'd love to talk to you anytime, and I really admire what you're doing. The website of Sister Giant is sistergiant.com, www.sistergiant.com, and I invite you, Vanessa, with the kind of orientation you have. Maybe you'll want to be at Sister Giant and do interviews, you know, with some of the participants or the audience or blogging or anything that you'd like. Certainly the orientation of your show is very much what we're about.
Cool, yeah, maybe we can think. I'm a Canadian, but I'm still interested in American politics.
So. Cool, all right, well, be in touch with me.
We'll be in touch, yeah, and just I wish you all the best with it, and I hope it's a huge success. So.
Thank you very, very much.
Okay.
All my best.
Take care. Bye.